Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo episode 103. I'm your intrepid host, Jonathan Metz, contributing editor at Nintendo World Report. And joining me today are...
Jonathan Lindemann, reviews editor, Nintendo World Report.
Now this is Greg, your over-caffeinated UK correspondent for Nintendo World Report.
And James Jones, your features editor at Nintendo World Report.
Okay, that's for the new listeners who may not be super familiar with our voices.
Shame
and
on
associating
you.
Them, so hopefully that helps. Yeah, not shame. welcome our new
would
listeners.
Would the new listeners be need for familiarizing with what episode this actually is?
Yeah, exactly.
Should we explain what our jobs are? Because I'd really like to know what the features editor is supposed to do.
You edit features such as this podcast.
Hey, here's an idea. Oh. You know what we could do is we could go around and say what we think other people's jobs are. I'm sure everybody would have an opinion on what they think job is.
Your job is to go, yes, you've sufficiently told me how bad this game sucks.
Well, we'll get to that later, actually. Yeah, right. We'll talk about that
later. That's fair
enough. But, we usually start the show off with something we call new business, and that's where we kind of catch everyone up on what we've been doing in the world of video games. And, John, I would appreciate it if you would start us off with that.
My new business, the first new business I have is that I have to announce that the Spiderwick Chronicles review is half done. I worked on it a little bit over the weekend. You know, I sat down and I kicked half of it out, so it's on the cusp.
I'm excited.
It's on the cusp of completion, guys. And so I've been playing it a bit more, and I've actually gotten to the point where it's not really difficult anymore, because what I was failing to do is I didn't realize that you could block attacks. So once that happened...
you see, the
beef I have with that is the fact that I shouldn't have to figure that out on my own. I mean, it should be very evident to
me. How's blocking done?
Well, blocking is done when you're in battle. Like, all the battles are turn-based. They're like, you know, a la Final Fantasy, right? And when you get hit, you tap on your character. So it's not really evident. There's nothing there to indicate to you that you could block.
Okay.
So it's just, you just kind of...
So it's like Mario RPG style?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the one comment I will make about that game is that it's kind of it's a mix of a whole bunch of different games kind of put into one. It's taken like elements from Phantom Hourglass, elements from the Final Fantasy series, elements from Secret of Mana, elements from Super Mario RPG, and it's kind of blended them all into a package that's good. Not great, but good. It's good. Let's see.
It sounds awesome with that kind of pedigree, but I'm sure it doesn't quite capture the magic of all those games you just listed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit... I think for kids it's probably a little bit too difficult, but I mean, it's honestly better than I thought it would be. It is definitely better than I thought it would be, so...
Are you playing anything, like, newer?
Not really. I mean, I've been trying to, you know, get reviews out of the way. And I mean, in terms of, do you mean on Nintendo platforms or other platforms, or
well,
what?
Anything?
I mean,
yeah.
Anything. I've been playing Grand Theft Auto 4, of course, and that's a really good time. The other kind of techie thing I sort of got, I got an Amazon Kindle. If anybody knows what one of those are.
Oh, sweet!
Yeah, yeah. It's the Amazon e-reader. So I guess there's e-readers from several other companies, like Sony has one. And essentially what it lets you do is obviously read electronic books. It's kind of like an iPod for books. And I'm actually really impressed with it. It's pretty cool. I'd gotten away from reading for a while, and I wanted to get back into it. And the Amazon Kindle always intrigued me. And it's really neat. The coolest thing about it is that you can wirelessly download books from Amazon.com anywhere in the U.S. because it piggybacks on Sprint's network, but you don't have to pay. It's just they must have some deal with Sprint where, you know, the Kindle can just use their network to download stuff. And so it's really neat, man, I got to say.
But you're paying for the books, right?
Yeah, the thing with that, you pay about $10 per book. It's cheap compared to, I mean, and that's the thing, that's for brand new books. I mean, books that just came out, you know, anywhere else you'd pay $25 or something for, like, you know, the new paperback edition or something. Off Amazon's Kindle store, you can just download them for $10. Older books are $5. So it's good. I mean, the thing I like about it, too, is that, you know, you can carry around up to, you know, 200 books on the thing, and you know that's all you carry around. You don't carry around, you know, three or four books if you like to read three or four books at one time. So it's cool.
Can it download like blog updates and things that like with RSS?
Yeah, it can do RSS blogs. Right now, it's limited to, you know, about a small amount of blogs. I mean, something like maybe like 200, but they're not popular blogs like. Let me think of one. There's a couple of ESPN blogs on there. There's like one for football, one for baseball, but there isn't anything like IGN blogs or any like gaming site blogs aren't on there. Obviously, our blogs aren't on there.
So I thought you could just add any RSS feed that you want.
No. And the catch is that you pay $1 per month for a blog. So. Per blog, so, I mean, in a sense, I mean, you're getting basically free cell phone service on it, so they have to subsidize it somehow. But the thing is, there aren't any blogs on there that I can't get on my BlackBerry, so I haven't really gotten anything. And same thing with newspapers too. There's about 20 newspapers on there from around the world you can get, but again, there's really nothing I'm too interested in. But overall, I mean, I think it's really cool. I mean, you know, I like it. I mean, you know, I'm the kind of techie early adopter kind of guy, so I enjoy it. But I think I think
it's something I might go for when the price comes way.
Yeah, I would say maybe even wait for the next hardware revision of it, because you know it's going to be like the iPod. Like when the iPod first came out, it was very simple. It didn't have a color screen, anything like that. And I can see that happening with, you know, the Kindle later on down the line. You know, it'll get like a color screen and that kind of stuff. But for what it does...
Doesn't the Kindle have like a really, really awesome screen? Like it's supposed to look like real paper.
Yeah, it does. It looks really good. I wouldn't say it looks like real paper, but it's non-reflective. It's just has this weird non-reflective coating on it, and it's this kind of dark gray color. But yeah, it really does emulate the look of a book well. I mean, for reading, for just being an e-reader... reading blogs, you know, it can play MP3s, but it just does it in shuffle. So all of the other stuff, if all you want it for is to read books, it's absolutely amazing. But people that want it for other kind of stuff, they should probably wait until, you know, maybe a year or two down the line.
Cool.
Yep.
This has been Tech Corner with your host, John Lindeman.
Well, that's the thing. I find like everybody's so curious about it that I become like this kind of Kindle ambassador, because everybody's like, oh, I've heard of that. So,
well, you're the only person I know who has one, but I mean, I'm definitely curious about it, but I think I'm going to be a late adopter on that.
Yeah,
sort of
I mean, if you read a lot, like if you consistently read, you know, like there's some people that just, you know, chew through books at a pace of, you know, a book a week. I mean, it'd be right up their alley.
Yeah. Yeah. I do read consistently, but I read slowly because I only read for 5 or 10 minutes a day. So it'll take me a month to get through a book, even though I read practically every single day.
Yeah.
So I'm not really that, like, really high-capacity user.
Yeah. I mean, I'm much the same way.
Sounds cool.
But it's good. I like it a lot.
Sweet. Okay, Greg, what you been doing?
I've still been playing a bit of Pro Evo. I actually took it online this week. I wanted to take a little time to, you know, bolster my game a bit before I braved.
I want to play you online. I want to play you online.
We should do that. Didn't even occur to me that someone else might actually have a friend code.
I mean, it never occurred to me that anybody else would buy it, because, I mean, nobody over here is buying it, that's for sure.
Yeah, well John and the problem is everyone over here that's probably had it since March, so like really hardcore into it, I don't want to play that. You know, I'm
exactly.
Just going to get murdered straight away. But I was kind of expected to get, you know, very roughly handled, but I think I was up against someone quite inexperienced. It was a competitive game the first time I played, but the main thing really is the technical aspects of it. It seems to have performed pretty well. It's quite solid. There was a few moments here and there of sort of, you know, jitteriness with the play. You know, they suddenly move relative to the field. You know, clearly some sort of lag or some sort of correction going on there. But in general, played pretty smoothly, really quite well. I have no problem with that. Finding a connection seems like it could be a bit of a problem, but you do have like sort of the ability, like it will say like how good the connection is with that particular player, and you can kind of decide whether you want to like trade off between like the ease of finding a player in terms of like obviously it'd be more easy to find bad connections, or you can say no, I'll wait until I get a good one. So that's kind of nice that it's got some sort of feedback. Mary Striker's Charge had a slightly different way of doing it, but, you know, again, it had some sort of feedback of how good your connection was going to be, with the person. So I appreciate that, because it's not nice to sort of finally get a game and then it's really terrible with anything.
Smash Brothers.
Yeah, you know, because it just feels like you're kind of obliged to play it then. You're locked in, but you're not going to enjoy it. So it's not that wouldn't be particularly good. So it is nice to have that feedback beforehand. So at the very least, you know what you're in for.
Smash Brothers. Sorry.
Oh,
well, you know what you're in for.
Yeah,
with
I was
that.
Just thinking.
You know what you're in for.
You know
with
what
that.
You're in for with that before you connect.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
To be fair,
people
yeah.
with Smash Brothers, people defend it by saying that there's so much stuff going on that's why it runs slowly and it's hard for them to make it smooth online. But I'm thinking, like, a soccer game, I mean, you got what, like 20 guys on the screen running
yeah.
around,
and of course you
are,
and of course the interesting thing
passed in physics.
Yeah, and the interesting thing with this game, of course, is that you're controlling multiple people at what you know, I mean, I would have thought it'd probably be easier with the old school Pro Evo, where one person is being controlled at a time and the rest is sort of AI. But in this case, yeah. when you're actually motioning, you know, you could be controlling, you know, several different people within a space of a small, you know, however quickly you can motion your pointer around. So, yeah,
same
I mean,
thing
it's
with...
pretty sophisticated, and it does seem to handle it quite well.
Yeah, it's the same thing with Mario Kart Wii. I mean, it's keeping track of, you know, multiple players on the track at one time. Multiple players,
yeah.
multiple characters.
I mean,
there's a lot of stuff going on.
I mean, I would still kind of think that Smash Brothers is really, really difficult. Like, you know, it is more difficult than these things. But I just don't know whether it's as much more difficult as the performance is as much more bad. You know,
yeah,
exactly.
That's the thing about it. It is a disappointment, obviously. But I mean, what I will say about Pro Evo, obviously, the kind of game that. You know, it's not Smash Brothers, but it does have that sort of, you know, very much capacity for sort of human individual creativity with how you play the game. So the online functionality certainly appreciated in that sense. That, you know, if you because I mean, I haven't played that much against the AI to like know its tendencies that much. I've generally played with a person next to me, but. You can imagine with a lot of sports games, after a while, you kind of get the sense of what an AI does, and it becomes quite stale in that. So having the online there as a way to be able to shake that up if you want a game and you can't do it with someone in person is definitely welcome.
Yeah, like if you talk to anyone who plays a lot of sports games, they'll give you stories about how they beat the computer in Madden like 200 points to 3. And even in FIFA, I used to have a roommate who would play FIFA. He'd play it on the hardest level, I think, and he would still just destroy the computer like 10 points to 1
every time.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously it was more
of a... Because you do learn where the holes are.
Yeah,
and
it was more of a problem in the old days with the simpler AI. You know, the holes were bigger and even more exploitable, but I think it still goes on.
Well, Tecmo Bowl.
Yeah. But that's, right. I mean, that was part of Tecmo Bowl's charm to me, though, was the fact that you could inflate the scores so high. I mean, I never expected...
Yeah.
The thing is, I wasn't trying to be realistic.
I think that's the very definition of an apologist.
Well, the thing is with that is that I never expected Tecmo Bowl to really give me a realistic game of football. It was just a strictly arcadey game of football.
Yeah.
Now, when I can beat the computer in Madden like that, I think that's pretty annoying.
Yeah, it's more of an issue.
But you can, though. I mean, like, in the NCAA football I paid 50 cents for, I can regularly score 150 to nothing. I mean,
and
just,
I assume
just
this
wanna...
isn't one of those really wonderfully mismatched college games. I assume this is like, you know, sort of top.
Well, even against like good programs, I can, you know, get 70 to nothing.
There you go.
To put this in perspective, I once scored 280 points in a game, and the highest score ever was 255 to nothing, Georgia Tech versus. Some college who wasn't even fielding a football team that year.
Yeah.
So, what?
So they were in the game anyway.
Georgia Tech scored on every play. They scored a touchdown.
Oh, this is like a real historical...
That was a real game. They scored on every single play. Yes. But
how could they be playing against a team that doesn't exist?
They made a contract a few years before that game to play a game, and then that school stopped fielding a team, so they basically just pulled a bunch of guys off campus and told them to go, as opposed to having to pay the contract fine.
That's brutal.
There you go.
It was like 255 to nothing, and I've scored 270 plus in that game. And that game only has 5-minute quarters.
Yeah. You always hear about the years of Madden where you can basically run. There's like this one running play that the computer can never defend,
yeah.
and things like that.
It's the same
so
way here.
That's
it's
where online comes in and makes a big difference.
It's
yeah.
the reversal from the shotgun set, which is a fake pass. handoff to the running back, instant touchdown every time you use it.
Wow.
From your own 5-yard line, you're going to get all the way to the end of the field.
It's the Bo Jackson play.
Yeah.
Except it doesn't apparently require Bo Jackson to do.
No, I've intentionally caught the ball in the end zone and let myself get downed at the 1-yard line on a kickoff just so I could see if I could run the 99-yard play. And it works like 80% of the time.
I've heard of certain coaches, Belichick, running up the score, but I hadn't heard anyone actually... I hadn't heard of anyone running up the yardage on people before. That is a new level of... skullduggery there, James.
Yeah.
I actually had a game where I accumulated... You get accomplishments for like things like yardage and stuff. I had a game where I accomplished so many yards that I leveled up my EA gamer score 3 levels in 1 game.
Yeah. That is fascinating. Greg, have you been playing anything else?
I picked up Dr. Mario, actually, this week.
Oh, and, despite my warnings.
Yeah, well, it wasn't really despite your warnings. I mean, first of all, I've never owned or played Dr. Mario in any form ever.
In that case, I think it's fine.
So there's that. And second of all, I was more interested in Virus Buster anyway. So it's kind of like the one half of the game. I mean, I'm not interested in the online particularly. And given my given my deficit in Dr. Mario, you know, because I've never played it before and presumably a lot of the people that have this do, I'd probably just get destroyed anyway. So yeah, that's not really an issue for me. And I have played the Dr. Mario side a little, and I'm rubbish at it. It's really bad. But I've mostly played the Virus Buster side. That's a lot of fun. I really like that. I haven't played it co-op yet.
So you did not play Virus Buster in Brain Age 2?
I've never owned Brain Age 2 or 1.
Oh, okay.
No. But, I don't regard them as like good games or anything. I just never got around to picking them up. I mean, I've probably got more DS games than I have for any other system, but there's still plenty that I haven't bought. You know, and there's just so much stuff on the DS. It's crazy. This was my first time with Virus Buster as well as with Dr. Mario in general. And I like the sort of the tactileness of it, of the fact that you're manipulating sort of all the different pieces, and it can kind of be a test of your reflexes in those moments where you sort of line something up in a combination so that when the pills disappear, there'll be bits falling and you need to very quickly sort of file them into the relevant sort of columns then to get further combinations. That bit sort of, you know, there's almost like a twitch element to it there, which is kind of nice. So
it's very twitchy.
Yeah. So it's kind of a bit, you know, so it's because it sort of starts off quite sedate, but I'm sort of playing it on the hard mode and the higher levels now. I can kind of clear up to level 17 on hard. So I'm just generally...
Oh, nice.
I'm generally getting better and better at the Virus Buster, and I haven't really played a whole lot of Dr. Mario yet. But I'm sure I probably will eventually, just because I haven't done it so far. I think Virus Buster...
It's definitely more relaxing.
Yeah, it's just, there's something nice about it. You know, it's a game where you're just playing it with the remote, you know, there's nothing else, but at the same time, can be quite involved, and you know, it's not. Yeah. I don't know. Just when I play the normal Dr. Mario, it just feels a bit distant and kind of clunky. Where you're like, you know, sort of depressing the button to rotate it, and that's all you can do really. And then, like, obviously, the big difference in the game styles is that you can't move the sort of pills, like, you know, that when they fall, can you?
You know, well, no, you can't. But even more important than that is that they can only feed you one pill at a time, because you only have the ability to control one pill at a time.
Whereas
in Virus Buster, you can kind of juggle them.
Eventually.
Sometimes it actually feels like you're juggling.
Yeah, eventually you get to a point where it's like 3 at a time. And all, you know, I mean, I do like it. It's just a bit more dynamic, I think. So
it's a lot more hectic.
I mean, it's kind of weird purchase because, like, I do think of Lost Winds or maybe like Toki Tori as more interesting games to me, but it was just like that kind of a sort of high scorey kind of thing that I was in the mood for at that particular time, and I've never played it before, so it was a kind of curiosity thing as well, and I've been enjoying it. I mean, I certainly can't disagree with anything you said last week or in your review. I think it seems all pretty valid, but as you've mentioned, you can still get some pretty significant entertainment out of it.
Yeah, I think it's a good bread-and-butter game for WiiWare. If you're not as enamored with the more experimental stuff like Lost Winds and Toki Tori, then I think Dr. Mario is actually a pretty safe bet. And especially if you're like Greg and you've never owned another version of, you never even played Dr. Mario, then I think it's quite good. It's absolutely worth the price there.
Now,
but this is a good segue, because one of the things I've been playing is Dr. Mario, Virus Buster.
Yeah.
And over the past week, since the last episode we recorded, I've gotten semi-obsessed with, like, trying to get to the higher levels, you know? So on easy mode, I got to level 30 before I basically just got bored with it. On medium, I got to level 20. And then on hard, I'm trying to work up to 20. I think as of today, I'm up to 15. So you're actually up higher than I am right now.
Ooh.
And it's so fast and so difficult. It's very twitchy. And to me, it feels like there's almost a lot of luck in how the colors are sorted
out.
Yeah,
there is. I'd agree with that very much.
So I end up a lot of times playing the same level four or five times before I finally beat it, and then I move on to the next one and play it four or five times also. But it's the kind of thing where, like, I'm having fun with it. The games are really short. You know, like, one round of it might be a minute and a half long before I give up or before I can tell that I'm not going to beat it.
Sure.
So it's like a nice thing to play for 20, 30 minutes at a time and get, like, really hardcore score attack, you know, mindset on it. And then once I've had enough, I just put it away, and you know, it's like there's no it's just easy to get in and out of, basically.
It's no compulsion associated with it.
Right. Now, yeah, it's not that addictive, so I know that I'm not going to spend 2 hours playing Virus Buster.
Now, which version do you think is the definitive version between the N64 one, the WiiWare one, all of these ones? Which one do you think is the best?
Well, I mean, if you are interested in Dr. Mario itself and not Virus Buster,
I don't own the N64 version of it, so.
Is probably the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the N64 version is probably the best because it has the four-player mode. And for that matter, I think Nintendo Puzzle Collection, which never came out in America, but it was a GameCube game. It has Dr. Mario,
one of the Yoshi ones, like Cookie or something.
Right, Yoshi's Cookie or something like that. So if you can get your hands on that and you have the ability to play import GameCube games, then that's probably the way to go, because I think the Dr. Mario in that is essentially an emulation of Dr. Mario 64. So if you can get that, that's probably the best deal. Otherwise, if you're really, really into Dr. Mario, the 64 version is probably the best. But if you want the best package overall, you should get the WiiWare one because it has Virus Buster. And that's really way better than Dr. Mario.
Coming to it completely fresh, there's no doubt. You could argue, well, it's just because you've played Dr. Mario before. I was coming to it having played neither of them before, and there's no question in my mind which one was more appealing. Although it's kind of more gentle.
Yeah, but you'd heard me say everything, so you still might be.
Oh, I'm impressionable, am I? So I don't have a mind of my own.
I think if you don't own any version of Dr. Mario and you're curious about it, then $10 for the convenience of, you know, having it on your Wii and not having to put a disc in or mess with an old system is worth it.
And it isn't that big, so it won't, like, you know, it won't. It's,
yeah,
it's not
like
60
blocks,
it's not like sticking one of John Madden's turduckens in the fridge, you know. it's more like putting in a little tub of margarine or something.
Okay.
All right. So, let's see. Other than Dr. Mario, I guess I would have to. Oh, let's see. I did start Half-Life 2 Episode 1, which has been on my computer since October when I bought the Orange Box over Steam, and I did play through Half-Life 2 and chronicled the trials and tribulations of that on a few episodes of the show back in the fall. Then I got BioShock around Thanksgiving, and just there was a long period where I wasn't interested in playing any of the Half-Life stuff. So I finally started that up, and I think the beginning of it's really good, because anybody will tell you that the best part of Half-Life 2 is the end. Mm-hmm. And
don't spoil it for me.
The beginning of Half-Life Episode 1 picks up immediately where Half-Life 2 ends. And so for the first 20 or 30 minutes, maybe even longer, you're basically doing the same kind of stuff that you're doing at the end of Half-Life 2, and it's really cool. And then it kind of slows down. You go into some other areas that are the parts that I really hated about Half-Life 2, like where you're underground and it's kind of swampy and there's like water everywhere and zombies milling around, and they don't drop ammo because they don't have weapons, so like you end up running low on ammo and health all the time. It's very dark. You have to use the flashlight a lot. It's kind of annoying. So I'm hoping that I'm through that part and that the next chapter is going to be different, so we'll see.
Episode 2 doesn't have a whole lot of that, so even if you get... Episode 2 has a whole new range of obnoxious things you have to deal with.
Yeah, I've said this before, but I really think Half-Life 2 and everything associated with it is quite overrated by PC gamers who call it, like, the best game ever made. I don't even think it comes close. I think it has a lot of design issues. But it does have its moments that make it well worth playing through. I mean, there are things about it that are still amazing, even though it's an old game. I mean, a lot of what blew people away back when it first came out was the technology behind it, and that stuff is not as impressive nowadays. But in a lot of ways, the game design still has some very cool things going for it, and I'm just kind of hoping that with Episode 1 and 2, because they were released a lot more recently than the original Half-Life 2, they will have a more... They won't be as reliant on, oh, isn't it cool that you can pick up this thing and stack it on top of this other thing? And it'll be more about creating interesting things to do. So,
yeah.
I think I'm about halfway through Episode 1, and I'm not going to finish it till sometime next week. But because I'm about to go to Bonnaroo. But I do like it so far, and it reminded me that this interesting thing about Half-Life 2 that I had kind of forgotten is that it's such a roller coaster ride. The game is so linear, and there's really, like, at any given time, there's really, like, only one direction you can go. There's only one place that you can go to, and even when they give you, like, a big room, there's something you have to do in that room, and then it's just a matter of finding the exit, because there's guaranteed that there's only one door that will open out of that place. And especially going through the very beginning of Episode 1, it literally feels like a roller coaster. It's like some parts are a little more exciting than others, you know, like the pacing is a little bit up and down, as you would expect, but the game just pushes you through that material so fast that it's actually really, really exciting, and that's kind of why it's a letdown when you get to, like, the next chapter, and all of a sudden it's like, and now you're, like, in the lull of the game. So we'll see if it picks back up, but I'm glad that I'm finally kind of clearing that out of my backlog, because that was one of my shames, that I bought these games back in October, and I had never even started playing them.
Well, so, welcome to my shame, Johnny.
Glad to be doing that. Yeah, I know. I'm not normally a guy who keeps a pile of shame, but this was one of the few games that was like that for me. So the other thing that I've played, and I'm not going to get too detailed on this because I don't think I'm supposed to, but it's Trauma Center Under the Knife 2 for DS. I have a final reviewable build of that, and I wrote a preview last week. It's just the facts, ma'am. I didn't do impressions because there wouldn't be much to say. I mean, I'll give you my impressions now. It's exactly like the last one. And by the last one, I mean Under the Knife 1, not New Blood. And I think this game has so many things going against it because, you know, I really, really like the Trauma Center series. And even I'm playing this thinking, this doesn't excite me. You know, like the last Trauma Center game came out about 6 months ago. 6 or 7 months ago. So it seems really too soon to be doing a new one, and especially because this one is not only like, it's not even at the level where I could say it's basically just the same as that Wii game that came out back in November. It's not even that good. It's like a step back, because the cool things about New Blood were that it had two-player cooperative mode, and it had voice acting for all the characters, which adds so... Because, I mean, 50% of the game is story. You're just watching dialogue. And so having voice acting makes a huge difference in the presentation and how invested you can get in the story. And because... I mean, it's not their fault, but because of the limitations of the DS hardware, they can't do either of those things in this. So this is a new sequel that actually feels like a step back in technology. And it's... If you've played... New Blood, which I would imagine that most of the audience for this game did play New Blood. I mean, that's the kind of thing they would be excited. They would want to get all the new sequels. It's going to be hard to go back to the DS style of play. You know, for the controls where you have to tap on the tools is slower. It feels not quite as precise as using the Wii pointer. And there's without the voice acting and the multiplayer, there's really nothing substantial to differentiate this game from the previous one. And so it ends up feeling literally like a mission pack. I mean, And not only that, but the missions that I've done so far, and I'm still in chapter 2, so I'm not that far in the game, but the surgeries that I'm doing so far are exactly the same stuff that you've done in the other games. You're draining blood out of tumors and, you know, sewing up lacerations. And so far, it hasn't shown me anything new. I mean, nothing. Nothing. So it's still really good. I mean, it's a high-quality game, and there's enjoyment to be had out of that. But if you follow the series and you've played all the other games, you know, I mean, just after playing this for an hour, I thought, you know, didn't they already remake the first Under the Knife for Wii?
Yeah.
Like, it feels like now they're remaking it for DS.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting.
You know,
because
I mean, technically it's a new story, but there's just nothing to speak of that they've improved upon in this.
It's interesting because even if you say just like take the, you know, that it's kind of like a sequel for the people that are just going to play it on the, that only played it on the DS originally, or like just because the DS obviously has a bigger user base, so they felt it necessary to do a sequel on the DS as well as do ones on the Wii. You could think they could maybe do quite a lot to advance the series, even if it would be in a somewhat different way to the console, which obviously
right.
has the benefits of additional storage for speech and the more potential for co-op and things like that. You could still think they could, just because they are somewhat hamstrung relative to the console version, doesn't mean they couldn't, you know, do a more meaningful sort of progression. So.
Right, and there are things that the DS can do well that the Wii can't do.
Yeah, so.
And, you know, I didn't expect for a new DS game in this series to have full voice acting
for every single
line of dialogue. That's kind of unreasonable.
Indeed, yeah.
But I expected them to do something new that you know, maybe couldn't be done on the Wii, or that they just never did on the Wii. And it's not. It is it's so straightforward. And, you know, I don't want to sound harsh on it because I do like the game. You know, I like all these games. But this feels like the kind of thing that if they had waited 2 or 3 more years and we had that kind of gap with no trauma center, then I would be happy with this game. I wouldn't care that it's not really an upgrade. I would be like, I just want me some more trauma center. But this is not even a full year after the most recent game.
Yeah, it's like the most obvious
and
rehash you could possibly get.
At this
get.
Point, I'm not ready for more trauma center unless you're going to do something really really jarring with it, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah. I mean, you know, that's not my full review. I don't want to damn the game because I've still got a long way to go, and it could surprise me later in the game. But certainly the setup is so formulaic relative to the other games in the series that it's hard for me to be really excited about it at this point.
But the thing is, that's entirely valid, though, because, like you said, the people that are going to be playing this are going to be people that, you know, kind of that like the Trauma Center games but also probably want something new out of it at the same time. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I think I am the target audience for this game. Really.
Yep.
And I mean, supposedly the majority of their effort on this game, and I say that relatively speaking because they can't have spent that long developing this.
Mm.
You know, if it's the same team as the Wii version that came out just a few months earlier, so I'm thinking this was done in a very short time period, and you can kind of tell that they're reusing a lot of ideas and surgeries and characters and art, but apparently the thrust of their effort was to make the game more accessible at the lower difficulty levels. And I can acknowledge some things like that where the directions are a little more clear and straightforward. But it's like, why are they going for new users when the game is called Trauma Center Under the Knife 2?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, do they really think they're going to be able to market this to brand new people who've never played any of the other 3 Trauma Center games? I kind of doubt it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, at the minimum, it would be people.
If they called it surgery training, then that would make more sense. But they're not, you know? This is a hardcore game. This is for gamers,
it doesn't
really
include a surgery peripheral, though, so.
Yeah.
Well, all they have to do is give you a stylus shaped like a scalpel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be a neat pre-order bonus, but
until your screen got cut to hell.
It wouldn't be sharp. Okay, smartass, James, what are you playing?
Well, I haven't played a whole lot this week. I pulled back out My Life as a King, which I have to say I expected I'd be playing a lot more after my initial completion. But for whatever reason, I haven't felt really compelled to get back into it, even though I bought the DLC for my second playthrough.
Ooh.
But I'm about two-thirds... Well, I only bought a little bit of DLC, but
no,
I expected
it's
that...
It's a little bit now.
Everything that was pink.
I only did
else.
A little heroin, officer.
But yeah, yeah. Look, I didn't buy it. I didn't buy it originally because I was reviewing the core game. Damn it.
Yep, that's right. The story.
So what you're telling me
it.
Is that if you'd had what you're telling me is if you had your druthers, you actually would be further along with the DLC.
You know, when Greg started that sentence, I fucking knew he would use the word druthers. I knew wow. I could hear Johnny it coming in my mind. I was like, yes, he's gonna pull out the druthers.
The fact that
and I have a psychic connection that the Atlantic Ocean can't defeat. Well, but anyway, so you're saying you would have preferred to be further along with the DLC. Is that something you're comfortable admitting on the podcast?
No, I'm saying that I would have rather... I think it would have been better if I had played it with DLC the first time.
Oh.
Because...
The way it's meant to be played.
Yeah.
The way it's meant to be played. It's a $60 game.
Because...
You get out when you put in, James.
Look... Even with the DLC, I've still only paid something like $20. Mm-hmm. So,
well, it sounds like you've gotten a lot of game time out of
I did.
$20.
And the thing about it is, a lot of those dungeons that they add, the dungeons are leveled. So it's to be like, this dungeon is like a level 25 dungeon. A party of adventurers that are in level 25 should be relatively competitive in this dungeon. But... And the final boss is something like a level 27 dungeon. And it's really just the final boss and that's it. But there are dungeons added when you buy the big dungeon pack that are like level 40. But if you beat the final boss, the game's over. So you basically have to unlock his dungeon and then just completely forego him and just go off on all these extra dungeons.
That sounds like a Final Fantasy game.
But the funny thing is...
I mean, they're all like that. Yeah. If you want to do the crazy side mission... I mean, they all have side missions that are actually harder than the real final boss of the game. And in order to go and complete those side quests, if you want to, you kind of have to get right up to the point. You have to be able to tell when the game is about to end and then pause and step to the side and do all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And then eventually come back and finish the story.
And
that's how they've been for forever.
Right. But usually they don't have like 15 extra dungeons beyond the level of the final boss. And the thing is, these levels are supposed to be relatively good indicators of where you'll be competitive, but that scale starts to vary wildly as the levels get up, because the dungeon before the final boss's dungeon is level 25, and I was sending in a party of level 27s and they were getting their ass beat, so they weren't really getting in until like level 29. So I have to imagine these level 40 dungeons are somewhere you have to be like level 50 to get through them. And I'm
so James, have you been playing anything else?
Nothing else new. I played more Battlefront. I played the other single player mode this week, which is I think it's called Conquest, and it's essentially you build fleets and island hop or planet hop as it is turn by turn across, and if fleets meet, a fleet battle starts, and if your fleet arrives on another planet, you engage in combat on that planet. You're awarded money based on how many planets you own and the outcome of missions, and then you use that to buy new unit types or like individual battle upgrades or build new fleets. It's really just time consuming because it's about 30 planets, and you'll probably lose one or two as you go. And then you have to go.
Well, it's a shame that the Wii didn't exist when that game came out so they could port it to the Wii.
Yeah, that could have been... It could have been interesting on the Wii, at least.
I say this partially in jest.
Well, no, it actually could have been.
They certainly could have made a GameCube version, and they did not.
Yeah, no.
Although, I guess, what was that, like 2005
or 6?
5 or 2006. I can't really blame them at that
point.
Yeah,
the GameCube
for
was dead.
Caring about GameCube, because Nintendo didn't care about GameCube either back
then.
Yeah,
but there are some of the shooting mechanics could have worked quite well with the Wii Remote, because they felt a little bit looser in this game than its predecessor, so maybe that could have helped out a little bit, or made it even worse. But it's a good time waster, but besides that, there's not a whole lot to say about it.
Alrighty, well, that is new business, and now we're going to take a break. We'll be back with your mail. The Nintendo Channel presents Lindsay Lohan plays Nintendo DS.
Yeah, like, this thing is great to play whenever I have 5 minutes between recording my new album, snorting cocaine, or starring in the latest Disney movie for teen girls. Yes, I can quit! Nicotine is the devil. Smoking is not sexy. When I heard there's a new game to help you quit smoking, I was like, oh my god. There really is something for everyone on the, Nintendo DS.
Okay, we are back with listener mail, and we'll start off with a letter from Adolf, and John Lindemann, you are in charge of that one.
All right, Adolf writes, do you want old-school Nintendo propaganda movies to be on the Nintendo channel, like the Star Fox 64 one with Rumble and such? Gentlemen?
Hell yeah.
No, I'm good with my America Ferrera Plays Nintendogs videos.
I don't know. I think it would be cool if they did have kind of a, like an old school corner, like with some really old like Nintendo commercials from the 80s. I think that would be pretty funny.
Yeah, the museum.
Yeah.
I think it'd be a cool idea. The Star Fox 64 one is about 20 or 30 minutes long, so that's maybe pushing it for Nintendo channel.
Yeah.
But at least, you know, has anyone ever seen the weird Japanese commercial for Legend of Zelda where Link
yes,
is played by a girl?
I've seen that.
The big musical
stuff.
Production.
Yeah,
it's really weird. You know, I would love to have the original Smash Brothers commercial.
Oh yeah, that's
where
weird. Isn't
you know,
it?
They're like prancing yeah. through the grass and then they start to beat each other up. I mean, that's really funny. So I think some like actual short 2 minute. Or 30-second TV commercials would be cool, but I had the Star Fox 64 commercial and it's awesome, but it's too long, and I don't know, it would be hard to select just one excerpt because there's so many good parts to it. You
well,
know?
And it's good because it's so bad. It's part of
yeah.
the thing.
Yeah.
In fact, I would argue that the Pokemon one is even worse. That one That one is almost unwatchable. It's just painful.
I think anything involving Pokemon is unwatchable.
But I remember back in like the early 90s to the mid 90s, my Toys R Us location, actually probably right up until the N64 came out, had this big TV with like this like panel under it that had all these Game Boy and SNES games, and you press down on it and it would play the commercial. And I just remember all the commercials sucked so bad.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah, they've made a huge step forward with We Would Like to Play and stuff like that.
And I'm almost worried that pulling these back out would be an embarrassment for all parties involved.
Yeah. I think they should take the Virtual Console approach and broaden it out so we can see some of Sega's old propaganda stuff. That's way better. Anything to do with the Sega CD must be priceless in retrospect.
Oh, yeah.
How would you
say... Do you guys remember the original Star Fox commercial when they said, why go... You know, Sega's slogan at the time was, go take it to the next level or something like that. And the Star Fox commercial said, why go to the next level when you can go light years beyond? I had a friend when I was a kid, and he used to run around and just say that all day. Like, he was totally indoctrinated.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man.
That's chilling.
So... Yeah, but as far as the other propaganda videos, like the ones that they actually sent to your house on VHS, there was definitely one for Diddy Kong Racing. There was one for Donkey Kong Country. That was the first one that I ever got.
Oh,
and
it I think
had
I've
at the very
that.
Like if
yeah.
you let it run past the credits at the very end, they had this teaser for the Ultra 64 where there were like some guys at a table playing Killer Instinct, and you see it for about 1 second, and they're like, No, get out of here, and they shut the door. It was awesome. I watched
so
that
cheese.
Over and over. And they had another one at one point that was like just a general Nintendo 64 video.
Right.
But it had like 3 seconds of footage from that very early build of Ocarina of Time.
Oh.
And I was upset. I would watch that. I would rewind it and watch it over and over and over. And it was like... Link was fighting a Stalfos, which isn't even in the game, and then he's opening this treasure chest, and you see and he pulls the Triforce out, I think.
Yeah, is this where that all came from? The stupid Triforce is in Ocarina thing when it makes no sense in the story at all.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the source of so many rumors and fake tricks and cheats, you know, and things like that. But So they used to do this pretty often, and now, you know, obviously the Nintendo Channel is the next generation of that. They don't even have to physically mail you anything. They can just deliver it up that way.
Mm-hmm. I think the last time I did anything like this was they used to distribute, really early in the GameCube's life, these mini DVDs in like a flip top that looked like a GameCube top. And I remember.
But it wouldn't actually play in the
GameCube. Yes, it wouldn't play in the GameCube. And I remember even the videos in that were just really bad.
Yeah, they handed those out at the Cube Clubs.
Target stores had them in like a display you could get. I think they were the only store that had them.
Yeah. And they had the disc itself said, like in big letters, does not play on the actual GameCube system.
Yes.
And I just thought that was so ironic. I mean, doesn't that just tell you that maybe you should have put DVD playback in your system?
Yeah.
I don't know. With GameCube, I understand why they didn't. With Wii, I really don't.
No,
yeah,
that,
I really don't.
But that is baffling.
It's kind of inexcusable. Anyway, next letter.
Right,
Greg?
Oni writes, hey again, guys. Today, I was wondering about your take on developers that seem to favor developing for one specific system, not including first and second parties. For example, I mean Suda51 for both of Nintendo systems and Itagaki for Xbox. Do you think that it's because of because of a deal behind locked doors or other stuff? And I guess, I mean, there's probably various reasons for this. I suppose with Igaki's case, some of it's just like, obviously, in terms of I doubt he'd work on Wii just because he's too much of a graphics guy.
Exactly.
Well, he did work on DS.
Yeah, the DS is like a bit, you know, it's a bit different. It's sort of a substrata of, because it's handheld. And, you know, they did
you
push...
You mean a superstrata.
Well, they did kind of push it as hard as it could go.
And
no
he did, and
that.
He admittedly did that because his child asked him to.
Yeah, that's what he says anyway. So even he was saying, I pretty much it was a gunpoint situation. So
that's also why he put massive breasts on all the characters in Dead or Alive.
Yes,
because his kid wanted him.
I think he's actually said in the past that he prefers to develop on the Xbox architecture than the PS3 architecture, and I think that's why sticks to it. He's just something that he prefers to develop for, and it just makes his life easier.
Yeah, that's the other aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is mostly like a practical answer in that it's not about money hats. I mean, those are real, I think, but they're very rare. I think it's usually a matter of, you know, when the question is specifically about, well, it's not specifically about small developers, but I think when you get down to these like kind of insular studios, especially guys like Suda51, a lot of it has to do with resources. They just don't have the capability to develop like a big multi-platform game. And if they did, they wouldn't have the attention to detail that makes their games what they are. And also, it is a kind of a familiarity with the hardware. Yeah. Like, they don't, you know, like a guy like Suda51 doesn't really want to go have to deal with the complications of making a PS3 game because he already understands how to make a Wii game. Mm-hmm. And so, when you're working with a team of 20 people and you have 10 months to make a game, you'd really prefer to just kind of go with what you already know. And so, that's why they end up forming what seem like allegiances, and they sort of are, but they're not. Based on like ideology,
it's more like networking than it is like alliances, like strategic alliances. It's just networking. Yeah. You know, people get embedded and in certain ways of thinking. And obviously, I mean, pretty much the only reason why No More Heroes is probably on Wii is because of the GameCube familiarity and because of the similarities between GameCube and Wii. I would have thought in terms of following.
He said that he did it because he saw the controller and he already had the game idea, and when he saw the controller, he immediately jumped on it. But that could just be spin that he created to sell the game, too.
Well, I mean, you have to think that the thing is, these guys will go out and hire a development team around a certain platform. So it only makes sense, instead of moving people that were hired under the auspices of developing for one platform, that they would just keep them on that platform and just keep that team going. You know, I'm sure from a hiring standpoint, it's a lot easier to just stay on, say, the Xbox platform than to move over to something else.
And you do see posts.
John,
go ahead.
Well, John, do you remember the time that we, this was like at E3 2001, where we had this outdoors interview with Dennis Dyack, and he's like sitting in a stool, and I think Billy was in a stool also, and then the rest of us were just kind of all crowded around.
Yep.
Were you there?
Yeah, I was there. I remember that.
Okay, I don't know if you remember the contents of that very well, but Dennis was... He is a funny guy, but he was particularly funny that day. because, you know, this was right after they announced that Eternal Darkness was moving to the GameCube, and it was right after they announced that Nintendo had purchased a stake in Silicon Knights, so they were now like an official second-party developer. Mm. And and Dennis really drank the Kool-Aid of mm-hmm. Nintendo. He was like telling us rumors about how the Xbox was going to fail because their graphics chip just plain didn't work. Like, they got the first prototypes and they all failed. And, he was telling us that the GameCube is actually more powerful than the Xbox because of this and this and this, and most people just don't know how to use it. And this is what happens when you get, I think these platform allegiances do start out of practical reasons, but if they continue on long enough, some developers really kind of go crazy on it, and like Itagaki, they start to disparage the other platforms, which is totally unnecessary, and in Itagaki's case, because he's currently unemployed, probably not the best idea for his future career.
Well, we know he's going to land on his feet somewhere.
Somewhere. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want to work with the guy based on the stuff that he says, but what do I know? What I'm saying is that, like, eventually a lot of these developers do kind of become insulated with that platform that they're used to working on, and they start to get kind of fanboyish and you do hear that.
It's partisan, isn't it? It's partisanship at some point.
Right, And it's unnecessary, honestly. Well, I mean, we're Nintendo fans, and I don't have to sit here and make fun of the Xbox 360. I want one.
I heard they break
a
lot.
There's no need for me to disparage the competing platform, because it doesn't matter. And for a developer, they have a little more vested interest because they want to sell their game. And so there is some advantage to them to kind of whip up that fanboy mentality and get people excited and think that, well, if I buy this guy's game, I'm supporting Nintendo and I'm attacking these other systems. So there are times when it may be advantageous for them to get into the system wars, but I think it's kind of silly.
Yeah, I think that there definitely is fanboyism, though. Just like, you know, I mean, in normal dev stuff, it's like some guys like C++, some guys like Java, and they're like, oh, he's a Java guy. Oh, yeah. It's completely...
Yeah, and look at Mac versus PC.
Yep.
I mean, that's insane. And honestly, with Vista now, there's very little difference.
Yep. Yeah,
in terms of the software, very, very little difference between Mac and PC. And yet people are still just so crazy over the so-called war between them. It's like, who cares?
I think a pretty good contemporary example of some of this stuff would have to be Factor 5. And, like, you know, the kind of the PS3 stuff when they were doing Lair.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was significant sort of vault farce on that once Lair didn't really work out. And then they've moved on to whatever else they're moving on to. We know they're doing something for Wii. But they've certainly...
Yeah, that's a great example, Greg, because they were not only really boosting up the PS3 and saying, like, the stuff they're doing can only be done on the PS3, blah, blah, blah. But they're also making comments about how... They're also kind of disparaging the Wii, or at least Julian Egbert was at least disparaging Wii developers.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if he said anything in particular about the hardware.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what it was more of the platform in terms of as it was at the time, the software that was on it. I mean, you don't really have to read it. I mean, because a lot of it was tub-thumping, sort of like, well, we were doing better on the GameCube 6 years ago or whatever.
Well,
it's factually accurate,
fact.
You know? I mean, you can't argue with that.
No.
So I don't know whether he was being that... he wasn't being particularly diplomatic. I think we can agree with that. In terms of... You know, I'm sure they've cooled on their pro PS3 sentiment since then, but at least...
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. I think part of this, you notice it a lot more in development houses that are very much like a cult of personality. You notice it in Shinji Mikami's development team, because he was very much... you know, GameCube focused. He made that famous, if Resident Evil 4 gets ported to the PS2, I'll quit my job statement.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which he didn't until a few years later.
Right.
He's at Platinum now.
Suda51 does it, and he's... Grasshopper Manufacturer is very much centered around him. Itagaki did it, and Team Ninja was, until recently, very much centered around him. And
you get it with Valve, with Gabe Newell, and Insomniac with Ted Price. So, yeah, you're right. It has to do with these companies that have, like, very public faces on them, and they seem to be the ones... And it's probably the media's fault for teasing these kind of comments out of them.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
I think there's a lot of
provocative questions, yeah.
Yeah, well, it gets you a lot of traffic if you can get something controversial like that. We should move on to the next question. Yeah, we got a lot. So the next question is from Shortstop WMD, and that person writes, "Hey, I was just wondering what the name of the RFN theme song by Jason Ricci and New Blood is. P.S. I upgraded my man beam.
Man
Congratulations.
Sounds like someone else. Someone finally caved to all those emails from Godfrey Wang to me.
Well, welcome to the next level.
Indeed. But we don't really have a theme song per se, but if you mean the song that plays at the beginning of the show, that one is called I'm a New Man, and that is on their newest album, which is called Rocket Number 9, but you can also just download song by song if you want to from iTunes. But yeah, if you're looking for that particular song and you want to get it, it's called I'm a New Man.
Is anyone else disturbed?
I highly recommend
by
it. It's one of my favorites.
Is anyone else disturbed by the synergy of I upgraded my band beam and what he was asking about? Did he know what it was?
I'm a new man. I upgraded my man beam.
That's pretty clever.
I think we were set up, man.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. Okay, next question, please.
All right. Golden Phoenix writes, to start off, it's great to have you guys back on. The week seemed like an eternity without Johnny, Wormhead, Lindy, and Gregors.
Terms of endearment.
Anyway, with High Voltage throwing their hat into the Wii ring with the conduit, are there any smaller developers you'd like to see stretch their wings and create a new IP for Wii? Which small developer do you think has a lot of untapped potential but seemingly been wasted by creating other publishers' games for them? Keep up the good work, or in Johnny's case, a pint of whiskey.
Well, no, you didn't read that right. Yeah. She gave us hugs, like with an emoticon.
You can read that, man.
or in my case, a pint of whiskey. And I just want to say, I don't even like whiskey. Vodka, please.
But, maybe that was the plan good stuff all along, too. Johnny. It was just to discover your drinking preferences.
I think we've discovered his drinking preferences already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's no secret. I once lived in Russia. I'm a vodka man. I think this is a cool question about small developers with untapped potential who are kind of trapped into making licensed games or things like that. And I think to go back to and I won't harp on it for too long because we talked about it last week. But I think Vicarious Visions.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Is a studio, and the reason that I would choose them is the problem I have with High Voltage, although I'm sure there's some really talented people there, I find it hard to be optimistic about this Conduit game that they're self-publishing. So far they're self-publishing, I'm sure they're looking for a publisher, but I find it hard to be optimistic because they haven't done much with their licensed games. And I know it's very difficult within the constraints of working with a license and with a publisher to do a really good job and to be innovative and creative. But if you look at another developer like Vicarious Visions, I think they actually have done that.
Yeah.
They've had some very difficult licenses to work with, some shitty ones, and a lot of times they've produced very compelling games and that are worth playing even if you don't care about the license. And they've pushed forward technology. They've done things with online that Nintendo hasn't even matched yet. Yeah. So that's why I would choose them. And if they suddenly announce that they're making a Wii game that is self-published and they're looking for a publisher, I would be so much more excited about that than I am for Conduit because they have that pedigree. And High Voltage, God bless them, has made a lot of shit. And I will be pleasantly surprised, and I certainly hope that Conduit turns out to be amazing, but I have no proof that it will.
Well, I mean, might get a first sort of indication with the WiiWare game they've got coming, Gyrostar, which is some sort of shooter, which looks quite interesting.
Well, you know, they've already got a WiiWare game
out.
The
Blackjack.
Right. Apparently, they have others in that vein.
Yeah, I mean, apparently the Gyrostar actually could have been released first, and they might have actually preferred it that way, but it's basically done, but Nintendo controls that sort of thing and doesn't really tell anyone when they're going to do... they're going to really put them out, so they kind of don't know when their own game's going to be coming out by all accounts at the minute. But presumably if it is done, it can't be that far in the future, so we'll get some sort of idea of what they can do when they're not constrained by license, although obviously it's quite a different game from an FPS. because it's it's just a side-scrolling sort of shooter. One choice I'd have, which is not like probably the best example for this, but in terms of just like for the console, for Wii specifically, I'd be quite interested to see what Q Games could do, because they've kind of done smaller stuff, like they did DigiDrive for the, they're doing the Pixel Junk games, things like that. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see what they could do with a full sort of Wii game, whether or not it was, in conjunction with Nintendo. Because, I mean, I like pretty much all that. I mean, DigiDrive's definitely one of my favourite of the Bit Generations games. Really quite interesting, different kind of puzzle game.
I don't think they did DigiDrive. They did Dial Hex.
I'm almost certain they did DigiDrive.
Okay, they might have done two of them, but I know they did Dial Hex, and most, if not all of the rest of them, were developed by Skip.
Yeah, Skip, that's right. They did the vast majority of them, at least five of seven, but I'm almost certain they did DigiDrive for Q Games, and that's very good. I haven't played Dial Hex, but it strikes me as being a great deal more interesting than that, actually. But you know, obviously they like these small little creative games. Although obviously they did Star Fox as well on the DS, and we know they're doing something else with Nintendo for the DS at some point. But Wii wise, you know, whether it be WiiWare or something else, I would like to see what they could do.
Yeah, I'd like to see what Way Forward could do if they ever move to the Wii. Because they did, they did
nice
Contra
choice.
4 on the DS.
Yeah,
and
well, they're doing
WiiWare,
aren't they?
Are they?
They're doing a puzzle game called Lit, I think it's called, which is...
Right, it involves light and shadow. Yeah. It's like a survival horror puzzle game.
Yeah, it's kind of... I'm a little vague on exactly how, what it's going to play like, because we haven't really seen anything of it already, but yeah, that's generally the feeling I got from what they've talked about so far. So that could be interesting.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'd actually like to see Flagship make something, but I'm not sure they even exist anymore in the current formulation. Because I felt like they did a pretty good job with the Zelda games they made.
Yeah, I don't think they do exist anymore, sadly.
Yeah.
I think Okamoto, he was the head of that studio, and I think he left to go do something else.
Right. So, I mean, I can't think of anybody right off, because every time I had someone, one of y'all said it, so...
No, they did a pretty good job, though, when you think of the Oracle games and Minish Cap and all that. They weren't necessarily groundbreaking, but, I mean, they were in terms of, they did follow kind of the Link's Awakening kind of template, but they were very, very solid games and well-designed.
Mm-hmm. I think especially Minish Cap was very well put together, even if it was kind of short.
Yeah. I would throw out another suggestion, and this one doesn't quite follow into the guidelines, but I'll go with Treasure. And it's not that they've been curtailed in the past by licenses and things like that. I mean, they do make Gradius
licenses,
5,
yeah.
Which is awesome, and
yeah.
It didn't seem to constrain them at all. And they've made plenty of their own creative games. They seem to have enough of a reputation that they can basically sell their own original ideas to other publishers. But they are supposedly working on at least a couple of Wii titles, and we still don't know what they are, so I'm really excited to
totally.
See what that is.
I'm really stoked for that, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the next question goes to John Lindemann.
Deep Six from Illinois writes, with his guest appearance in Mario Kart DS along with Super Smash Bros. Brawl, Rob the Robot seems to be on Nintendo's mind right now. Do you think Nintendo is setting everyone up for some type of Rob product or game? It's most likely that the newly expanded audience hasn't heard about that failure that was a robotic operating buddy. So
Rob
he'd have
was
a
my
mostly
only friend.
So he'd have a mostly a James operating buddy. So he'd have a mostly clean slate upon a release. Plus, now would be the best time since there's the possibility of a lot of people mistaking him for an anorexic Wall-E.
Yeah, I included this question just for that last sentence because I thought it was funny. But
probably.
They could call it robot training. Million copies sold right there.
My robot and me.
You have to train your robot to do something. That would be like Wonder Project J2 for the N64, where you have to train a robot to speak English, basically. Except it's a Japanese game. Maybe you have to train it to speak Japanese, but... Anyway,
that's an obscure title.
I think what happened in Mario Kart DS was they were just looking through the backlog of characters they could put in that weren't specifically defined as part of another Nintendo franchise, and they came across him, and they're like, eh, hell, good enough.
It was very odd, wasn't it, that they went there with DS, but then they went in a very different direction to reach for characters in Wii, Mario Kart Wii.
But they did put him in Smash Brothers.
Well, Smash Brothers actually makes more sense than Mario Kart DS or any, because it's like it's all about. It's like, how different is it from the Ice Climbers, really? That was in Melee,
right?
You know, it's trading off the same kind of thing, like really kind of.
Oh yeah, it's like it's
or
well,
Game
it's
and
really,
Watch.
Really like Game Mr. Game and
yeah,
Watch.
As yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah. I think, you know, I really don't think that just because Nintendo has some reference to one of their old characters that it means he's coming back.
No,
you can go to Ice Climbers and Mr. Game & Watch for proof of that. I don't think they have any intention of making a new Ice Climbers game.
And they made a new
it's
Game & Watch game.
It's just fun to bring back these characters because they're nostalgic and they're funny.
Oh, yeah,
they
I
released
mean,
that
fair.
Game & Watch game in Japan, that DS one.
That it came out in America too, but that was...
No, I'm talking about the DS compilation where they actually used the DS.
Yeah, was that
a
Club Nintendo thing? Was it like Tingle's Balloon Fight and all that? They do lots of things over there, the Club Nintendo sort of perks, Mario Galaxy
soundtracks. Yeah, but you could barely even say they released that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was such an obscure thing. It's probably worth a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, they're worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
No, yeah. Let's
By
face
the way,
it.
Club Nintendo in America sucks.
Well,
even the one in Europe is way better. You guys can get like virtual console.
Yeah,
points,
it's
right?
like a kind of yeah. The stars are like on a 4-to-1 sort of exchange rate with Wii points or something. You know.
Yeah, but there's a limited number that can be given out every month or something like that.
Yeah, there's definitely restrictions. I remember when I was cashing mine in, it took me ages to do it. It's just like most of the time you went there and it's like, nope, nothing available right now. It was like, what? You know, it's code.
Well, from what I read on that, because I was actually going to research that for a feature at one point, but then backed out of it, was they intentionally put these limiters, like you can only sell so many Wii points in a day or in a month or in a week, I don't remember.
Yeah, probably sounds
because
about
they were
right.
They were afraid of it greatly decreasing the value of the Wii points as a whole. Like, it'd be like flooding the economy with fake money, or rather with printed money.
That's great.
They were,
you know, that doesn't make any sense, James, because that model only works if you are able to trade the points among each other.
Since when has what Nintendo America said they couldn't do that because of the vast geography of the United States?
Are you serious?
Yes. They can't do...
That doesn't make any sense.
They can't
either.
Adopt a model like Japan or Europe because of the vast size of the United States. Japan makes sense because they're shipping shit.
Japan is 4 islands.
Yeah, but it's still... It's only the size of California total. But they can't send virtual points because of the size... What the fuck, man?
Yeah,
that's terrible. That sounds like someone asked a question to Reggie or whoever answered that, and he wasn't familiar with the context, so he didn't have like a canned answer, and so he had to make something up on the spot.
Yes.
And that's what came out.
This sounds like a Perrin Kaplan answer.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay, so... all right, next question from, Greg.
This would be me, yeah. So, once again, Sarah from Iowa City, Iowa. This is actually her question, rather than her remarks about John and whether he gets to sleep. Wait there, John. I haven't used my Sandman-like powers on you yet. The question is, what is the worst game you've ever reviewed, and what was it like to review a really bad game?
It was just like listening
if
to
Greg
you talk.
If Greg is the Sandman, then James is death.
So cold.
No. I'm not. It's not cold. I'm saying you're the cute, pale faced chick who. Okay, Neil Gaiman. Never mind.
I lost.
So what's the worst game you've ever reviewed, Death?
Yeah, go on, James. Well,
I know
stuff on this.
Yeah, James will definitely have some input here.
I'm gonna go. This is a hard call.
Pick a favorite. Isn't
I gotta hear this. Actually, it's actually quite intriguing.
Gonna go with Pokemon Mystery Dungeon simply because I was able to beat Miami Knights in 4 hours.
Oh, now you see, this is the thing. Your review, though, for that, the build-up to it was great. You know, I've been heard on the podcast for ages, and then it was sitting in editing for ages and all that.
Yes.
I was expecting it to be like one of these Bronson revenge movies. Like he was gonna rape and murder your daughter in the first act, and then he was gonna spend the rest of the review trying to hunt it down and then deliver some pithy comment and then blow it up with a grenade launcher.
Well, you know,
it didn't quite deliver on that. But I'm glad for me that the antipathy's still there.
The version I sent to John was different from the version I was writing myself before we decided to do this combined review thing.
Yeah, you sent me kind of some point form.
Yeah, I kind of backed it down a little bit because there was at one point where I accused this game of causing all the maladies ranging from global warming to volcanic eruptions.
You're accusing it of creating Disaster Day of Crisis.
You know, James, this sounds like a good use of the staff blog.
Oh, it gets better, because one of them was I accused this game of causing a mass murder that was going to take place in Japan because I was about to fly out there and go do it myself.
Ooh, and that just happened.
Yeah, so that's a good thing I didn't get in.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you can take that part out and put the rest on the blog, because that would be fun to read.
There was I had to keep editing out the swears I was putting in there. Because I knew John wasn't going to let those through.
You tell me you had, like, the typing version of Tourette's.
Yeah, essentially.
I'm trying to be objective in the graphics, but shit, it's awful.
I think I got to gameplay. I think at one point it just said, no, I'm not going to talk about this. It's just bad. And then I went back and started putting in accusations of divine retribution for this game's existence.
Wow. Yep. So,
well, anyone else got one they want to talk about?
I've got Slam Dunk, because most of the games I've reviewed have got quite a lot of redeeming features, except for Hurry Up Hedgehog.
Right.
Yeah, there's no real game there. It's a board game. That's it. There's no reason for it to be a video game. So, yeah, there's nothing really to say about it. It's just, you know, it's very dubious why it's on the DS and it's not particularly well executed even for that.
I think the what's it's like to review a bad game varies from bad game to bad game. Because in the case of Mystery Dungeon, it was just constant pain. I constantly felt like this game was conspiring to prevent me from ever finishing its review and thereby warning people not to play it. Whereas with Miami Nights, I just felt like I had acquired herpes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on how much time you're required to put into the badness of the game in order to get a good review out of it, you know? To get a good review out of a bad game, I guess.
Yeah. You
know, that's a big thing.
In a way... Go ahead.
No, you go on,
James. In a way, it can be easier to write a game that's for a bad review than a game that's really good. Because you're critiquing a game, and obviously you have to have something to criticize in a bad game. You've got plenty to criticize. Whereas in a good game, you don't have a whole lot to criticize, so you're kind of having to work with the good elements of the game, but not sound like you're being too flowery on it.
Right. You don't want to sound like a cheerleader.
Yeah.
For me, that involves... The way I handle that is, like, I try to kind of think about the game design on a... not a theoretical base, but I try to kind of deconstruct it academically. Yeah. And I try to... A lot of my reviews are kind of based around this sort of academic look at what makes the game fun or, you know, what is the one problem with it. And a lot of it goes into, like, level design and game design and controls and things like that. And those are the kind of the things that I find really fascinating. So when I have to talk about a good game, God forbid, I usually try to focus on those things. And if I'm having fun with it, I think, okay, why am I having fun?
Yeah.
Because if I can explain that, it might help people who are reading it decide whether or not they would have fun with that, or if it's something that just doesn't appeal to them.
I think an important thing to do with reviews as well is to not be too accepting of design, because that can be easy to do when you're playing games for fun. It's just, oh, that's just the way it is. You know what I mean?
Whereas
you can't, you can't do that with James's review.
Yeah.
You have to look at it, you know, every design element is a choice, and you have to try and assess why they did that and was that a good decision. You know, if there's a trade-off, if there's a certain structure that they've pushed you towards, if they've encouraged you to do certain things and discouraged you to do other things, there must be reasons for that. You know, this isn't arbitrary.
Right.
It's not something that just fell from the sky and then into your DS or whatever. You know,
usually the reason or in many cases, the reason that they made they chose the things they did is because they're just copying previous games.
Yes, right. So you can look at you can look at those. You know, is it just following a template? Is it is it trying to get you to very sort of methodically trying to push you in one direction rather than sort of leaving you to your own devices? Is it trying to sort of shape, like, say for instance with handhelds? You know, how much is it influenced around trying to get you to play in short bursts as opposed to sort of long periods, or does it force you to play long periods when perhaps it shouldn't, things like that.
Yeah, and I would like to hear Greg deconstruct Hurry Up Hedgehog at a theoretical level.
Yeah, well, read the review. I did my best. I really did.
It's a pretty good review. You should check it out.
Obviously, James and I have a limited library of games to draw upon. So really, it's one for the ages. Let's hear from you and John.
Well,
John, you've been around as long as I have.
Yeah,
although not the whole time.
You know, thankfully, it's funny. I'm actually just looking at on the site, the list of games I've reviewed, and it makes me laugh because Jeff Shirley comes up right before my name of Sorted by Author, and you have Jeff's reviews, which are classic for. He's actually done a whack load of reviews too, like a 2, a 4, a 2, a 1.
I didn't even know you were allowed to give out ones.
A 2, a 3.
Yeah, of course we're allowed to use the entire scale, James. Yes.
I thought one game had to just not work.
Well, that was for Charlie's Angels.
You're right. Yeah. Never mind. Yeah.
You read his review. You will not feel that's unjustified after you read his review.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that game's got a legend behind it.
Yeah, it's a terrible movie, too. But, thankfully, I've been able to... thankfully, I've been able to pretty much, avoid... Well, the thing is now, as reviews editor, thank God I can dole out the crappy reviews instead of getting a hand.
The catbird seat for John.
What was that game that sat in the review queue for like 2 weeks and nobody wanted to touch it?
The Homie Rollers? Was it Homie Rollers?
Oh, was it?
Homie
Rollers
was one of them. Yeah, I'm sure Zach on here and he could rant all day.
Good going, Zach.
Yeah. I haven't really had anything that's absolutely terrible. I remember I did review Mr. Driller 2, and that was just complete, like, just rehash, just nothing to that game. But that's probably one of the worst. But thankfully,
Can you see what the lowest score you've ever assigned is?
The lowest score I've actually ever assigned is a 6. So I've gotten some pretty good ones.
Wow.
Yeah. I've gotten some pretty good ones.
6 months, I've already got a 3.
I've reviewed like 5 games and I've given out more lower scores than that.
Yeah.
Well, I think I've reviewed, in fact, I know for a fact I've written more reviews for our site than anyone else.
Absolutely,
and,
man.
I have over 150 reviews
Dear God.
8 years. So, I think the lowest score I ever gave was for Fortress on the GBA. It was like a very early GBA game.
Uh-huh.
And so I can talk about that one for a sec. It's like a really badly done Tetris clone. Like, the controls don't work, and there's like a lag in the graphics. And it's like, Tetris is not that complicated of a game. So, like, if you're going to make a clone, you have to at least get the mechanics right. You know, it has to feel good. It has to feel like you're playing the game. And they broke that, okay? And then the idea was that... It wasn't just a Tetris clone. They were adding this element of strategy because some of the blocks that came down when you're built, the idea is that you're building this castle out of Tetris blocks. And some of the blocks that come down are turrets and things like that that'll attack your opponent. And the problem is you have no control over when those turrets come down, and it doesn't matter where you put them. So there's not actually any strategy involved.
Nice.
All you have to do is just play Tetris, except you can't really play Tetris because it's broken. And the whole
Tetris.
Concept of, like, it's you versus this other guy, like either a computer or another player through the link cable, that doesn't work either because you can't actually see the other castle being built. So even if you could... control, even if you did have some manipulation over the strategy of like where the turrets go and if it actually mattered, you wouldn't have any idea what to do because you can't actually see what the other guy has. So the game is pointless. Like, the fundamental concept of the game doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not to mention that mechanically it is broken and it actually is not fun to play. So
I would like to point out something real quick. 2, 3, 4. The 6 worst games based on score that we've given out ever are all reviewed by Zach, Jeff, or Les Thomas.
Very nice.
Well, I mean, part of that is the fact that...
As for what it was like to review a really bad game, thankfully, most of the bad games I've had to review didn't take that long to go through. But in the case of Fortress, it wasn't so much what I went through while I was playing the game, it was what I went through afterwards, because the publicist for Majesco at the time, who was publishing that game, sent me an email and obviously took up issue with my review and, you know, was like, how can you complain about this? You know, I remember actually I think for last ability, I gave it a 1 because you can only, like, basically, like, it takes about 10 or 15 minutes to play through a round, and every round is the same. Like, there's no, you know, there's just no replayability whatsoever. The multiplayer mode is useless because, again, there's no actual strategy. So there's no interaction. And so I gave it a 1. I said, you can see everything this game has in less than an hour. And then you won't even have fun for an hour. So, I gave it a 1, and her email said, how can you give it a 1? That's the lowest it can be. And I said, actually, it can go down to 0.
What would a game have to do in last ability to get a 0? Would it have to just not turn on? I mean,
it's like, months, yeah, I guess so.
I think it would have to be like 5 minutes. I think, you know, it would have to be like Star Soldier R, except without the replayability.
Yeah.
Well, you know, without the impetus to play it over and over and do better.
Jeez.
It would have to be like a linear adventure that's 5 or 10 minutes long. So, like, once you play through it, you would never want to play through it again. That's what it would probably have to be for me to give it a 0. You know, but Fortress was almost that bad.
That is pretty awful sounding, actually. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks everyone for the listener mail. We had fun reading it and talking about it. And if you'd like your question or comment read on the air, you can send that to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And by the way, please don't send it to the mailbag on the website, because then Steven has to forward them to us, and sometimes he forgets or he sends them way late. So if you want to send the email through the website for some reason, like you don't have an email client or whatever, you can just go to like the staff contact page, and there's like a drop-down list, and you just change the name of the person to Radio Free Nintendo, and then we'll get your email. So you can do it that way too. All right, we're going to take one last break, and we'll be back with your WiiWare and Virtual Console news, and we'll wrap up the show. Okay, and we're back to finish up the show. This week on WiiWare, we have My Pokemon Ranch for 1,000 points, and I happen to know that Mike Gammon, our previews editor, has already downloaded it because he sent me a screenshot.
Yay.
He sent me a snapshot over WiiMail today.
1,000 points?
1,000. 10 bucks.
It doesn't just look like an N64 Pokemon game, box. James. It costs one. It's exactly the same.
Yep.
I don't know, man. I saw a video of this on the Nintendo channel today, and the graphic, like the character models for the Pokemon themselves, actually look worse than they did on the N64 and
yeah,
Pokemon
well, you
Stadium.
Know what the reason for that is, I think, is because they've gone for this weird style where, like, they're kind of, like, me-ized, if you know what I mean. Like, they've kind of been deformed to make them look like me. So, like, in some cases, the characters kind of lend themselves to that, and they don't look too weird. And then you get stuff like Pikachu, who just doesn't look like himself anymore, and it's like he's the icon of Pokemon, and he doesn't even look like himself.
You're not supposed to make Pikachu look different.
He looks like an origami bobblehead version of Pikachu. I mean, that's
right.
It's just abysmal. How can you get it so that Pikachu doesn't look like himself? I mean, it's just that surely is the basic premise of the game, is they look like themselves. It's just
You would think so. I mean, I saw that, and I could tell that they had tried to make it stylized, but like the polygon counts are really low.
Yeah.
I mean, these things are jaggy. Look, they're like blocky looking. They really look like N64 models.
Yeah. Well, how much are origami? They look like they're folded. You know, that's how they've constructed them. It's just, you know,
yeah.
Well, do you think part of that was
atrocious?
Do you think part of that was having to deal with the fact there are something like 490 Pokemon now, and they had to fit it into
in the memory constraints,
a downloads size?
Well,
do you
I just
think
want
part
to get
of that
quickly.
Is that they gave this project to one dude, like an intern well, yeah. at ACL, and gave him 3 weeks to make it, and they want to sell it for as much as possible?
Yeah, well, I'm not doubting that, but...
Yeah, this seems like minimal effort, maximum return.
Yeah, you know it's going to get plenty of downloads on the strength of the Pokemon name. And I'm sure really hardcore into it Pokemon people will get something out of it. I'm sure they will, because it's probably useful for people that are swamped with Pokemon on their DS card and they want somewhere to put them.
I have thousands. I'm a master.
We'll hear about it when Pale writes his review, because he is... quite the Pokemon hardcore guy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. If even he can't recommend my Pokemon Ranch, then you'll know it's a piece of shit. Because Pale is a pretty bad Pokemon fanboy. So
I hope he gives it a 10.
Alright. On Virtual Console this week, we have Dig Dug for the NES and Biomiracle... Bokute Upa.
Just
and,
the two games that everybody was asking for, by the way.
I know, these were high on the list.
I've been waiting and waiting.
Yeah. And oddly enough, these are both import games, and I could have sworn that Dig Dug was released in America on the NES, but apparently not. I know for a fact Dig Dug 2 was, because I had a friend who owned that, and I like Dig Dug 2. I don't really like the original that much. John Lindemann, you're old. Tell us about Dig Dug.
Oh.
Dig Dug, it's kind of, I would classify it as sort of swimming in the wake of Pac-Man. It came out when everything was a maze game. Basically, you're a little guy underground, and you're digging through tunnels, and to attack your enemies that also come after you, they chase you down in the tunnels, you inflate them and blow them up. And the goal is... I don't think the goal is to clear the screen of enemies. I think it's actually to get to the top of the screen and then walk off the top of the screen.
I thought the goal was to collect diamonds or something.
Nah. I think it's to actually get up to the top of the screen and walk off, I think. I think that's how you get to the next level. But, yeah, I mean, it's okay. It's one of those games where it's kind of like you play it for a little while. It's not like Pac-Man where, you can always go back to it. Dig Dug really doesn't have that staying power. It's classic, I guess, but... just the fact that they never released it for the NES in the US, I think that's pretty telling.
Yeah, I don't... the NES version might not even be a good version of it. I don't know. Obviously, I've never played it. But we also get a more interesting import game this week, also 600 points. Biomiracle Bokute Upa, which is a Mario-style 2D platformer starring a baby.
Yes, with a rattle.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yes, with a power-up that makes it walk on two legs.
See, that's the thing. Like, why this game? Why bring this over of all the games that are out there?
John, you answered
apparently
this
game has sort of a cult reputation.
Well, John, really? You answered this question last week. You said they have a dartboard, and they have some stuff on it, and they throw some darts at it.
But how did this even get on the dartboard?
Yeah, well, that's another story, I guess. I think that's a more convincing explanation all the time.
The dartboard.
This game actually had a U.S. release as a black market pirate game because there was a label put over it, over the actual original label of the game, that read that it was Mario Baby, because whatever crafty Chinese importer that brought this in recognized the game plays almost exactly like Mario, as opposed to jumping on the enemies, you shake your rattle at them. But there was a pirated version of this game that had the label, the another sticker on top of it that said Mario Babies. And this this came out
it
of
really
my.
It really does look kind of like Mario. I mean, the primary mechanic is different because you're sort of inflating these enemies with your rattle like Bubble Bobble, and then you can either jump on top of them to float upwards, or you can jump into the side to push them off like projectiles at other enemies.
Yeah.
And it looks pretty interesting. And we were watching a video. I mean, it's very weird.
Yes.
Very weird, like level designs and character art and things like that. But it looks like it could actually be pretty fun. I mean, I'm sort of curious about this, so I'm looking forward to hearing what people say about it.
Like the backgrounds were like giant cakes, and then in World 1, 2, and it has that Mario structure of worlds. And in World 1, 2, it was the whole world was a cake, and the baby was eating its way through it, sort of like Dig Dug. So it was able to go up and down and to the sides and ate a path through the cake.
I'm just curious to see what the backstory is. I mean, is it
backstory?
Like I'm looking for some. Give me something here. Yeah, I mean,
this baby is having a dream or something?
Prince, and he has to like rescue the kingdom.
Wow,
from cake.
That's very demanding, isn't it?
I'm getting nothing out of that.
Royalty.
I think this game would have been a lot better if it had man beams.
Yes,
maybe
everything is.
Yes.
I do want to say
Man Beam Upa.
I do want to say one thing about these two games. Why do I get the terrible feeling in about 6 to 9 months when there's another import festival over here and we all want Rondo of Blood, Super Mario RPG, Earthbound, you know, Chrono Trigger, whatever else you want to throw in that didn't come out in Europe, we're gonna get these two.
Bio Miracle.
It's okay. Like, I think it's a fine substitute for Super Mario RPG.
I think you're absolutely right.
Shake your rattle, Greg.
This game is made by Konami, and most of their Famicom NES games are pretty good. So, I don't know. Maybe by next week we'll have a better idea. But this might actually be worth downloading. Dig Dug, I'm going to say, although it's an okay game, I've played it in various Namco museums and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I don't really think it's worth $6 at this point.
Especially for the NES version. I mean, you can just get it on some other compilation and it'll probably be a much better version.
Yeah, you could probably get one of the Namco museums for GBA or DS for like $10 and mm-hmm. it's guaranteed to have Dig Dug on it because Dig Dug is one of those games that they put on every single compilation.
Yeah.
And Namco has a bunch of them.
I mean, there's actually no words to describe what we get with these imports. I mean, maybe they just gave us this because they wanted to give us the polar opposite of what Europe got in Chouaniki. Maybe that was their intention. They just felt like they couldn't release Chouaniki to the ESRB, so they went and said, give us the most kid-friendly NES game you can find that never got released outside Japan. And some jackass at Nintendo Japan said, hey, we have a game starring a baby, how's that?
I'm still hopeful that we'll see Chouaniki at some point.
I just want to see what the ESRB says about it. I don't have to play
Me
it.
Too.
I just want to see the ESRB webpage to be preserved for all time.
And I want to see how Nintendo tries to sell it also.
Yeah.
I think the playbook's already been written on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean they're not just going to regurgitate it. I mean they have to try to one up Nintendo of Europe, you know.
I don't think NOA would let the phrase man beam get onto the Wii.
Hey, Johnny, they'd
have to come up with something a lot cheesier and even funnier unintentionally.
are you saying they're going to have to massage the text, Johnny? For Chouaniki.
Yes.
You're going to have to massage the term man beam.
Oh.
Terrible.
All right. Perhaps we should end the show on that note. Thanks, James, Greg, and John for joining me.
Always
and,
a pleasure.
Thanks to our dear listeners for putting up with us for another hour and a half. So we will see you next week. You won't see me, but you'll see these other guys next week. Bye-bye.
Later.
Later.
So long.
The Nintendo Channel presents behind the scenes of Lindsay Lohan's DS commercial.
Apparently, some geek from Nintendo called my dad and offered us a shitload of money if I would pretend to play their stupid game for 5 minutes.
Tune in next week to see Britney Spears playing Sin and Punishment.
Like, what the fuck?